Well, good morning, Commonway. That was so great, just getting to see so many of us doing church at home. Thank you for sending in your selfies. It's, for me, a reminder that, man, this is not normal, what we're doing on the one hand, and then on the other, that you all have done such a great job of just like making the most of all of this. So we are continuing our series on different stories from the Bible, and today we're going to look at a very old story that actually is, we're going to find out, surprisingly relevant for us today. So, Exodus chapter 13, a bit of backstory. So, God had promised the ancient Israelites that they would one day have a land all their own, this promised land. Unfortunately, they had been enslaved in Egypt for like generations. And so they never got to the land that God had promised Abraham, I mean like centuries before this. I'm gonna show you a map here to help us visualize what's going on. That part here in the middle, this stretch of land is called the Sinai Peninsula. And you can see there, really from the satellite, that it's like dry, barren land. There's not a lot of life. And then over here toward the left or the west, you see this area that's quite green. It's vibrant. Any guesses what this is? Yeah, that's Egypt. That's the Nile Delta region. And unfortunately, it's also the land of slavery. However, things grew there. There was food, crops, vegetation, fish. And then over here in this area, this is actually Canaan. That's the promised land, modern day Israel, and it kind of extends up to the north. And it's also green and vibrant, and that land flourished. It's the land, God said, flowing with milk and honey. And even better, here they would be free. So God comes to the shepherd Moses, and God says, I've seen my people, I've seen their hardships, I've heard their groaning. And then God says these beautiful words. He says, I will take them out of the land of slavery and into the land of their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's like really great news. I mean, God is gonna take them from green space to green space. It's like perfect. I mean, when do we get started? However, nothing is said about this wilderness in the middle, this desert. So Moses goes to Pharaoh and he says, let my people go. And you've all seen the movie or cartoon. And multiple times, Pharaoh says no. Now, each time he does this, God sends a plague on the Egyptians until finally Pharaoh relents and he says, okay, you can go, you know, get out of here. And so their exodus out of Egypt and their journey toward the promised land finally begins. Exodus 13, verse 17, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea, which if you're picking up on, one of the things this means right away is this is not the quickest way. And from the very beginning, God decides to take them on the long route, a detour. He doesn't pick the short journey. God leads them by the desert road. And there's already in that a bit of foreshadowing of what's to come for the Israelites. And they get to the Red Sea here, and the sea actually extends quite a ways to the south. And the first thing that you would notice is that is an obstacle to be avoided. The second thing that stands out is the Red Sea is not even on the way to where they're trying to go. It's not on the way to the promised land. And they realize they don't know what to do. They're backed up against the sea. They have no boats, and there's like a million of them anyway. And in the meantime, Pharaoh has had a change of heart about letting the Israelites leave. because who's going to build his summer palace, right? And so the Egyptian army with chariots and horses is in pursuit, quickly closing in behind them. Exodus 14, verse 10, as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? And what have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." I mean, it is amazing to me how quickly the people forget what God has done. I mean, the plagues against Egypt, the miraculous events of the Passover, I mean, like it never happened. They start to panic. They're freaking out. They're blaming Moses. Verse 13, Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." I love that. Moses steps into the water and he takes his staff and he puts it down in the water, and miraculously, the waters part. Hard to even imagine. They pass through the Red Sea walking on dry ground. And I imagine the entire time they're thinking, God has been so faithful. Why did we even doubt? And good news, we crossed this and it's just, you know, we're close to finally being in the promised land. And they get to the other side of the Red Sea, and chapter 14, verse 31 says, "And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and they put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant." And from this point on, the Israelites never lost faith in who God was or what he had done. Like, from this point on, they never complain again to Moses or to God when things weren't going their way. No. And sadly, that isn't what happens. See, what they don't realize is their time in the wilderness is actually just beginning. They're about to spend 40 years wandering around that Sinai Peninsula. What's crazy about this, it's actually only about 240 miles or so from Egypt to Canaan. I mean, that would be like walking from Muncie to like Evansville, right? Just imagine, instead of that taking a couple of weeks, you know, it's not fun, but it's doable. Instead of that, imagine it taking 40 years. Now, you just look at this image, and by the appearance of it, you might wonder, what did all of those people eat during those 40 years? That's a great question, and I'm glad you asked. The people get hungry, and they start complaining. Exodus 16, verse 3, they say, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Now, in response to this, God miraculously provides this food substance called, manna. Manna is the Hebrew word, and literally the word means, what is it? Every morning, in other words, this dew would fall and there would be this like flaky frost-like seed on the ground left over. They're like, what the heck is this stuff? I mean, that's literally what the word, how it got its name. Look at Numbers 11, verse 7. "The manna was like coriander seed and looked like resin. The people went around gathering it and then ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into loaves." So they'd add water, they'd boil it. I'm picturing something like oatmeal, although I have no idea. Eventually they like baked it into cakes, and I guess that's a little bit better. But I mean, come on, how many different ways can you find to prepare this and to keep it interesting? Well, it's not long before they're sick of this manna, this what is it stuff. Numbers 11, look at verse 4. The rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. That's not exactly true, is it? You know, other than the slavery. Also, the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. I mean, my first thought is, man, these people are whiners. Like, they just, like, complain all the time. Like, what is their deal? And then hang on a second. Because, you know, when we come to passages in Scripture like this, when people aren't at their best, perhaps rather than placing ourselves like kind of above them, like I would never act like that, it might be healthier for us to place ourselves alongside or among them to say, you know, given like the right circumstances, or if I was in this situation, I would be losing it too. In fact, just a moment of honesty, after how many weeks of quarantine? Notice I said weeks, not years or decades. After how many weeks did it take for me to start complaining? Yeah, exactly. Exodus 16, verse 35, there's this kind of offhanded sentence. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to the land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. And they're just going, we're sick of this. As Jeff Mannion says, we may think that nothing grows in the desert, but make no mistake, the land between is fertile ground for complaint. I love that phrase, the land between. Mannion actually has a great book by that same title. The land between is, in a sense, where all of us are right now. The land between, it's the land of disappointment, frustration. It's a land of uncertainty or inconvenience, boredom, despair, a feeling where you're just feeling stuck. I mean, haven't we all said lately, I'm sick of this. Just wish this would all end, or when will this end? And haven't we all said or thought, like, I miss my old life. I didn't realize how good I had it. Or perhaps, I'm sick of getting to the end of the month and trying to figure out what bills I'm gonna pay and which ones I'm not gonna pay, because I can't. Or maybe for you, being in the land between, it's not COVID related. It's just like, I'm sick of going to test after test medically with no diagnosis. Or I'm just really tired. I am worn down from a particular relationship challenge. Or I'm sick of being single. You know, I don't know what it might be for you in the land between. I'm so sick of this manna. What I do know is that we've all been there. And perhaps in various capacities and ways, a lot of us are there right now. We know the land between. You know, the thing with the Israelites complaining, it's like, come on, how serious can that be? It's just food, right? I mean, what's the big deal? But we find in their case, it's actually quite serious. Because in their complaining about the manna, when they say, we remember the food and all that we had in Egypt, and now we only have this stuff, there's something in their spirits where they're going, we were better off in Egypt. We were better off as slaves, which means what they're really saying is, God, we were actually better off before you got involved. See, they're drifting really close to something dangerous, something bordering on like treason against God. And so when they're complaining about the food, it's not just like they're complaining about bad, like cafeteria food, like no big deal. I mean, they're essentially saying, God, we wish you had never gotten involved in our lives. In fact, at one point, they start kind of this little movement where they're talking about choosing a new leader, going back to Egypt saying, you know, God, thanks for everything, but we're going to go see if the Egyptians take us back. That's a tragic place. Here's an important question. What are they doing out there in the Sinai Peninsula, wandering around in the land between for all those years? In other words, was the land between a necessary experience for them? Or was it just a pointless, wandering, meandering detour and that's it? When you look at this map again, and you realize when they leave Egypt, they're exiting Egypt after generations of not only slavery, but like being indoctrinated into Egyptian, essentially idol worship of all forms, to Baal, to all kinds of Egyptian gods and goddesses. I mean, they know very little about the creator God at this point, if anything. And where are they headed? They're headed to the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the land where God says, not only is this going to be your home, but this is where you exist and grow as the people of God. In other words, God says, I'm going to put you in the promised land to show people who I am, to show people what I'm like. And so somehow they need to end up, you know, end result in the promised land where they will have no God but the creator God. And by the way, the land that they're going to, the promised land, is also dotted with various shrines and idols to Baal and to other gods, which means they've left all that behind them in Egypt, but it's ahead of them where they're going. And so God is saying, you know, when you get to the promised land, I mean, the first time the crops aren't good or there's a drought or whatever, are you, in your desperation, going to run off and offer sacrifices to some local fertility god or goddess? Or are you going to depend on me? Are you going to put on display what trust in the one true God and worship of him only looks like? And so the land between, as challenging as it was for them, and as much as they didn't want to be there, it was the space in which they were to be transformed into the people of God. Which means, and this is the part they continually fail to grasp, God actually has them in this desert for a reason. He's actually going to use this desert time to form his people, to forge something within them. I mean, as they leave Egypt, as they journey toward the land of promise, I think God is whispering again and again, will you trust me? And again, they say, actually, no, we won't. I mean, it's actually not working very well. God rescues them from the Egyptians. And God's saying, I know you probably noticed that whole thing where the Red Sea split in two and you walked across. That's like kind of a big deal. I mean, you think that the Israelites would say, well, that settles it. Once and for all, we're going to trust God. They forget. They get thirsty and they start complaining. And so God provides water for them on various occasions. In one place, God commands Moses to take his staff and to strike a rock, and water flows out of the rock. I mean, what is that? Water out of a rock is a lot like water from nothing, like life from death. It's God saying, can't you see? I can provide for you out of thin air. I can give you what you need. And they're like, yeah, okay, we got it this time. But then pretty soon they're out of food. And their response is, if only we had stayed in Egypt. Moses, God, you're just trying to kill us out here in the desert. And so God provides them manna. My point is, by the time you get to Numbers 11 and they're grumbling and complaining over this meal that they eat over and over, the point is, this is not their first offense. I mean, round after round, God is going, when you get attacked, will you trust me? When you don't have water, will you trust me? When you have no food, will you depend on me? In chapter after chapter, God rescues, God delivers, God shows up, God provides. And yet, the very events that are supposed to form them and to grow their faith and to grow their trust, instead just grow complaining, bitterness. And so by the time we get to their whining here, we're tired of this manna, let's choose a new leader, let's go back to Egypt. I mean, at this point, they have been in the desert somewhere close to 2 years. God's attempting to transform them into a people of trust, and they just keep crossing their arms and saying, absolutely not, it's not happening. Just want to pause here for a second. I mean, what if the very event in your life right now, the thing that you most detest, the thing that you most like loathe, the thing that you hate, I mean, what if this is the very space in your life that God wants to use for your growth? I mean, there's something about the land between. When you can see green space behind you, like you remember how it used to be, you're hoping for change, you're hoping for relief, you're hoping for green space up ahead in your future, but right now, not so much. What if this space that you most detest actually has the most possibility of producing fruit that you most desperately need? See the land between? That's the place. That's the place where we actually learn to pray. It's the place where, again, because of current circumstances or whatever else might be going on in your life, that's the place where we get to the end of ourselves. We say, God, you've got to do something because I am out of resources. I'm beyond my own resources. I don't have peace. I don't have patience. I certainly don't have joy right now. God, I need you badly. So again, what if the space that we most deeply resent actually has the greatest possibility of producing the fruit that we really need the most? What I've come to realize, and perhaps you've experienced this as well, it turns out the land between is perhaps the only place where trust and these deeper things can actually grow. What happens when we're in the land between? We get so focused on what was behind us, on what used to be, or we get so caught up in where we're going or where we want to end up, we actually miss the purpose and what God is trying to accomplish in us in the desert, where we are right now. I want you to look at this verse again. It's interesting because you can actually read this in two different ways. Yeah, the Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled, etc. I mean, you can read that from the perspective of the grumbling Israelites. I'm so sick of this. I mean, 40 years, day in, day out, eating the same thing. Things were better for us back in Egypt. God, if this is what you're going to give us, we think we'd be better without you. I mean, that's one perspective, right? The other way that we can look at this is probably more from God's perspective, where God's saying, every day for 40 years, I provided for you. You went to bed and you woke up and I provided with you with plenty of food for the day. I provided for you out of nothing. Will you trust me? See, one way of looking at the land between. One way of looking at it is, wow, that was like a long time of just circling around, wandering in circles, and what a pointless waste of time. Let's go back to Egypt. Or you can interpret it the way God did. Deuteronomy 8. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years. to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. To teach you to depend on him. Verse 4, your clothes did not wear out and your feet did not swell during these 40 years. God's saying, I had a purpose for this land between. I mean, can't you see? I was trying to accomplish something in you that I couldn't do any other way. Can't you see that I was leading you this entire time? And oh, by the way, did any of you happen to notice your jeans didn't get holes in them? Your sandals didn't break. See, what we're talking about here is choices. Like choices of the heart. I mean, here's the deal. I don't get to choose what happens to us. I mean, you actually don't get to choose what the other person does or doesn't do. You largely, in many ways, can't choose what happens to your body. We can't control what happens with the economy. It's out of our hands. And you don't get to choose what happens to you. But you do get to choose your response. You do, in many, many ways, get to choose and to shape the person that you become. See, these are the choices of the heart that we all face in the land between. God, I'm sick of this, but I'm going to choose to trust that you see what I'm going through. God, here's my pain and here's my confusion. I'm going to trust that you hear my groaning, my complaint. I choose to trust that you're with me, even in this, even though it feels like I'm wandering in circles, and when will this end already? I mean, looking at all these examples, I mean, what if God still does this? What if God still loves to provide? What if God still loves to meet us in the land between? And so those of us currently right now wandering around this place, and we can all think of perhaps examples. I don't know what your needs are. I mean, God very well may provide for you badly needed financial resources, money. But he may also provide contentment, joy, laughter even, while we learn to live without the extras. I just think God loves providing exactly what we need at exactly the right moment. And so for you, he may provide that text or that email of encouragement. Perhaps he provides the people, right? Like the emotional support that we need to get through a difficult time. God may provide strength to help us like patiently care for our children, maybe one more hour when we find ourselves just kind of out of resources there. Perhaps he provides peace in a tough season. Whatever it is, I just want you to know that God loves providing. Providing is like what he does, and he does so with intimate knowledge of who we are and what we need. In the words of the Apostle Peter, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. I want to end our time this morning by singing, reflecting this final song together. And you're going to know it. It's an old hymn. And one of the things that I like about this, especially now, is as we reflect on how great God is, there's something about God's greatness that puts kind of our own stuff, our own issues into perspective. There's something about worshiping him for who he is that reminds us that, oh yeah, God has perspective. Not only does he have capacity and power to be involved, but he also has a vantage point that we don't have. He sees what we can't see. So I just want to encourage you this morning as we sing, as we reflect at home, wherever you are, whatever the land between looks like for you, that you would turn to him. As we're all tempted to complain and to go down other paths, and I get that, that we would turn toward him, to the one who is in control, to the one who is good, to the one who cares for us, and that we would worship, and that we would trust, and that we would let him do his work in us. Let's sing.